Okay, good morning, everybody. We're ready to get started. So this is Bio 231. It's September 11th. So we're progressing through September pretty quickly. And so that means we might have a test coming up. So let's take a look at the schedule. And I see we got a new PDF reader here. I don't know how to work this one just yet. I'd like to get rid of that. I'll figure out how to do that. But we can still see the schedule. Indeed, can you see the schedule from where you are? Even though it's in a little frame over there? Okay, I like that with as far as the lights are concerned. So today is the 11th, and we're going to start integumentary system. And you can see that's chapter 5. You see the page numbers you should be reading. Those are the same page numbers in your study guide. So that should be in good shape. So today's a Wednesday, and if we look at next week, 1 week from today, 11 plus 7 is 18, we have our first exam. Okay, so next week, Wednesday, first exam. And then the week after that, we have the first practicum. So we don't have practicums the same week, which is a nice thing. On the exam, you have chapters 1 through 6, but we don't cover 3. So 1, 2, 4, 5, and 6. So we're going to be done covering material for the exam toward the end of next week, today. I believe today. Okay, so here are the lecture notes. I did boot up the internet right here, okay, because there were some questions as to where do you find the study guide for chapter 6. All right, so let me log into Blackboard. Is it working? Yes. So, nice human anatomy. Okay, so where are the study guides, typically? Oh, there's my cursor. Course documents? Okay, lecture slides, study guides right here. And I think I have it broken down into 5 exams. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But how many are we going to get? We're only going to get 4. Yeah, 3 would be too much material on one test. Okay, so the organization in the study guides isn't exactly as it is on the schedule over here because we only have 4 exams. So chapter 6 is going to be in exam number 2. All right, so again, you can right-click, download it, but let's just double-check. And this is with figures. Sure, let's go ahead and open that one and see what it looks like. Here it is. Yeah, exam number 6, right, including the exam figures are down over here. No, that's not 6. That's 7. 7, 7. Are there no figures for 6? There might not be any figures for 6. There's only 2? Exam figures, 666. Okay, I don't see them on here. Okay, well, I'm going to make sure, I have to make sure that you guys have those figures in a way that you can work with. Why don't I have it on there? Exam 2. Okay, yeah, I'm not sure. Really not sure. Okay, I'll look on there and I'll send you an email when I have it figured out. Okay. All right, so let's start talking about the integumentary system. Unless somebody's got a question about the schedule 1 week from today, let's talk about what you need. An 8-8, is it a 2 or a 4? 8-8-2. Well, you know, if you have a question, let's just go to the syllabus right here, and it will tell you. All right, what's required? Okay. You need... here, 882, E, that's the best one. Don't get the 882 Lovas. I don't know if there's any floating around campus. I was at the bookstore. They don't have any. But the Lovas has the selections already darkened with some kind of color, and sometimes the Scantron reader can't read that kind of form. So get the one, the 882, which just has the white background without any kind of ink or anything in the bubbles that you have to fill in. All right, so that's one thing. You also need your validated Cypress or Fullerton College picture ID card. All right, so you do need that, and then you need a good pencil, And even more important than a good pencil is a good eraser. And there's a list of what kind of erasers work really good in the syllabus. Try it before you come to class. Make a nice mark with your pencil on a piece of paper and then use your eraser to see if it disappears. If it doesn't disappear, then just throw that eraser away because I don't want you to grab it when you're in a hurry. And usually it's the white plastic erasers that work the best. Okay, so that's it for the exam. And then you get the whole period. I'll try to be here maybe a little bit early for the exam. I'll try to come down right after lab, and you can have the whole period until the next class starts, which I don't know when that is. But as students start coming in, that's when the exam will be over. So it will go past the usual time. Okay, so only come into class if you're ready to take the exam, because I'm going to start passing it out as soon as I get here. It's not that people need a whole lot of extra time, but since it's the first test, some of you might like a little extra time just to see what that test is like. Okay. All right, so here we have a picture of the integument. And what the heck is the integument? The integumentary system. Yeah, skin, you know it's the largest organ in your body, right? Because it covers every particular surface. And is your skin. And skin has some components to it that you should be aware of. It's got a couple layers. It's got an epidermis, which is an epithelium. It's a stratified squamous epithelium. And then it has dermis, and that's connective tissue. Okay. And then there are some other things besides the dermis and the epidermis. You have hair follicles, and you have nails. Those are what we call accessory structures. They're part of the integumentary system. And even a muscle. Here's a little smooth muscle right here. It's not under voluntary control, and that's called the arrector pili. So this little muscle is a part of the integumentary system. And then nerves are and special receptors like this Pacinian corpuscle. So those are all some special structures that make up the skin or the integumentary system. Oh, and I forgot something. And I see it bulging out right here. That should be there. And I see it over here in section, and that is a sebaceous gland. You should know about three different kinds of glands in skin. On this diagram, I only see one gland. Okay, so integumentary system is composed of the skin and accessory structures like hair, nails, glands, and muscle. And you have a number of different kinds of glands, only one kind of muscle in skin. And for instance, you probably know a lot about this arrector pili muscle. When does it contract? When it's cold, for instance, because you can see that it's connected to this hair follicle. When it contracts, it tries to elevate the hair follicle up toward the surface of the skin, and that forms a little goosebump right here when you're cold, or maybe with emotional stimulus or something like that. All right, so the function of the integumentary system is not too complex, but this is a water barrier. So one of the first things is that it is for protection, right? It protects you from dehydrating, so it's like a special saran wrap. And without the skin, you would dehydrate and probably die maybe in just a couple minutes, maybe in a minute. So it's super important that we maintain the water inside of our body, and the skin does that. But the skin also protects our body from infection, from bacteria, viruses, fungi, and things like that. So usually those bacteria can't have access to our body through the integumentary system, okay, unless you have a cut or something. Then, of course, those bacteria can get through the integument and infect your body. All right, and then you know that the skin is important for regulating body temperature. How does that happen? Does it regulate body temperature when you're hot or cold?
Both.
Okay, but for sure I'm thinking when you're cold, when you're hot. Okay, when you're hot. Because what happens? There are glands like this sweat gland right here that secretes sweat, which is mostly water, contains some salts, onto the surface. And when that water evaporates, it needs some energy from your body in the form of heat to evaporate, so that cools your body down. Okay. So that's a good way to think of it. Also, it helps make a precursor to vitamin D. So it's very important for vitamin D production. So let's think, what the heck is vitamin D necessary for? It's very important in calcium metabolism, but especially for you to absorb calcium that's in your diet. So it will help get calcium that's in your gastrointestinal tract and absorb it into your body. Things that are in your digestive tract really are not inside your body. They're just in a tube that's running through some interior space, right? So we need to absorb calcium. And what do we need calcium for? Bones. Okay. And you're correct with that, but that's really incomplete. And we're going to talk about the important purposes of calcium throughout the rest of the class and even in physiology. So it's even much more important than that. And then, of course, the integument is important for sensation. Like, what sensations can you recall? Pain, sure. Maybe if you get a paper cut or something, or maybe you put your finger in the car door and close the car door, things like that, right? So there are pain nerve endings. What else? Yeah, what if I put an ice cube on your belly button? You're going to feel that, right? Because there's thermoreceptors in skin. What else? All these hair follicles. Okay, when these hair follicles move around, they stimulate nerves, right? So you can tell when something is brushing up against your skin. You can feel wind on your skin, for instance. All right, and, oh, I was thinking of another one, which I can't remember right at the moment. But it will come back to me. Temperature, for sure, is important. All right, so those are some important sensations. Okay, the other sensation was really kind of nifty, but I forgot what it was. Yeah. Oh, there's a special loop that has to happen, okay? But I want to tell you what that other sensation was, okay, before I answer that question. You might have to remind me what your question is, but some people can read with their integumentary system. How is that possible? Braille. Yeah, for instance, Braille. Not shown on this illustration, but in lab you have such things are called Meissner's corpuscles that are tucked away in these papillae right here, and these nerve endings that are very close to the surface of your skin are very sensitive, right? And they can feel very small vibrations, slight vibrations, and variations in the surface of things like Braille. So indeed, people can read by reading patterns of dimples, okay, on the surface of paper, for instance. Okay, so how does this erector pili muscle work? Well, there are thermoreceptors in your brain. There are temperature receptors in your brain. And your brain is monitoring temperature, your core body temperature. And when your core body temperature increases, the hypothalamus then says, your body temperature is increasing. It can recognize that it's not normal. It makes a decision on what to do. So if you're hot, it's going to cause these sweat glands to secrete fluid. Okay, and when you're cold, the hypothalamus makes a decision to do something else. It will shut down these blood vessels, and it causes these erector pili muscles to contract. Okay, so that's under nervous control. You can even see some of these yellow fibers going to this muscle that represents nerve fibers going to the erector pili muscle. Yeah?
So is that what causes shivers?
That cold response would be that causes shivers. The shivers are not necessarily due to this erector pili, but the skeletal muscle that's deep inside your body. So when you have the shivers, it's not just your skin that's kind of wiggling, right? It might be some major part of your body. Okay? Sometimes we call that fasciculations when skeletal muscle contracts, even though you're not telling it to contract. Okay, for instance, when you're really, really cold. And when that muscle shivers, it's breaking down ATP, and there is some leftover heat when that happens, and that's what warms your body back up. Okay. All right, so the main layers, I think everybody is drawing this in lab, the layers of the skin, right? And so you all know already that there are two main layers. And let's talk about the deep layer first. The deep layer is what we call the dermis. The dermis is connective tissue, so cells are far apart. And those cells secrete fibers into the matrix. So what would we call those cells that secrete fibers into the matrix of the dermis? Yeah, fibroblasts. So the dermis has fibroblasts. And they're busy secreting elastic fibers because skin is kind of stretchy, and then when you release it, skin kind of goes back to where it was before, okay, at least when you're young. And it also has collagen fibers, right? So there's a lot of collagen fibers, and that's what gives the dermis strength. Collagen is the strong fiber. There are more collagen fibers in the deepest layers of the dermis, and that's why it was called the reticular layer. It's kind of a misnomer because if you learned that it's called the reticular layer, what kind of fibers would you have guessed predominate in this layer right here? reticular fibers, but that would do absolutely no good, right, because they're so weak, right? Our skin would just be ripping and breaking apart all the time. It would be really useless. So that's just a misnomer, and so you should really know there's collagen fibers, and maybe I can see some collagen fibers in places here. We have some micrographs where you can see that very nicely. All right, so the reticular layer is dense, irregular connective tissue, and maybe there's a picture of what that looks like in your mind flashing by. Right, the superficial part of the dermis is what we call the papillary layer, and it's called the papillary layer because of all these projections up into the epidermis. These projections here and here and here and here, these are what we call papillae, dermal papillae. And these dermal papillae, and here you can see some papillae, and in thick skin, like what's covering the palms of your hands and your feet, these dermal papillae are very large and they aggregate together and they form fingerprints, for instance. So you've been aware of these things for a long time, right? So dermal papillae make fingerprints in some kind of skin that we call thick skin. Also in these dermal papillae, we see some nerve endings right here for pain, and not shown on this slide will be Meissner's corpuscles for very slight touch and very small vibration as well. Probably, I might be able to show you a picture of that. The other thing that you notice, you see these loops of blood vessels right here. Right? So this is a papillary plexus, and remember, epithelium does not have a blood supply, so these papillae take these blood vessels and they kind of shove it up into the epithelium right here, so that it helps nourish some of the layers of the epithelium. Right? So that's one of the reasons why they're there. The kind of tissue the papillary layer is areolar connective tissue. Right, so areolar versus dense irregular. And which one of those two is stronger and why? Areolar versus dense irregular. Which one is stronger? Dense irregular. And why is that? Because it has more collagen, much more collagen. Areolar connective tissue has some collagen, but not nearly as much as dense irregular connective tissue. So even the papillary layer of the dermis is stronger than the epidermis. Epidermis doesn't have any collagen whatsoever, but it's not as strong as the reticular layer. And you should probably know that this reticular layer is the layer that's used to produce leather products. Okay, and you all know that leather is a pretty stiff, strong kind of material. Okay, because of all of those, what kind of fibers in leather?
Collagen.
They're collagen fibers. Yeah, it's just a special kind of protein. Okay. So those are the layers, and even on this slide, you can tell that the epithelium is, the epidermis is what kind of epithelium in terms of layers? It is. So it's either going to be simple or stratified, and you can see many layers right here. As a matter of fact, I can see some color changes in there, right? So you know it's a stratified epithelium. And if we look at the layers at the apical surface right here, can't see it on this, but when we look underneath the microscope, you're going to see that these are flat cells, so it's a stratified squamous epithelium. That kind of epithelium is being regenerated all the time by the deepest layer, right? And so mitosis is taking place, and those cells then migrate up to the surface, and they get to the surface. They're really far away from these blood vessels. They're already dead by that time. And so they're designed just to rub off your body. So when you put on shoes or shirt or whatever, right, those cells just get sloughed off, but that's okay because this kind of epithelium is designed for that particular purpose, and then those cells are replaced by the ones over here that are regenerating by mitosis. Okay, the other thing that I see on this slide that I just point out in passing is this adipose connective tissue down over here, and this is what we call the hypodermis. Sometimes we call that superficial fascia. It's a loose connective tissue. It might be an areolar connective tissue that has a lot of adipocytes in it. So it might be hard to characterize as either adipose connective tissue or an areolar connective tissue, but there are a lot of adipocytes in there. And the hypodermis really isn't part of the skin, but you can see it attaches to the skin, and it is a connective tissue, so it connects the skin to underlying structures. So what could be right underneath your skin? Muscle, bones, things like that. So the hypodermis is important for attaching your skin to underlying structures like muscles and bones and other things as well. Okay, so we have a model in lab pretty similar to this, but it has a couple more little structures in addition to what we see right here. Okay. All right, so let's talk about the epidermis. And I'm just going to focus on this slide and then find a picture. All right, so we said it's a stratified squamous epithelium. Right, and but we don't call it an epithelium generally. We call it the epidermis. Why? Because it's on top of the dermis, and epi means on top of. So that's a pretty easy definition to understand. And the same reason why we call this the hypodermis, and hypo just means below the dermis, right? So that's how we come up with those names. All right, so stratified squamous epithelium is specifically designed to resist abrasion. And abrasion is what? Rubbing, right? Abrasion is when something rubs up against you. And because those cells are being replaced all the time, and a permeability barrier so that we don't dehydrate. So there's something special going on in this epidermis that prevents you from dehydrating. And the cells we call keratinocytes. And these cells we call keratinocytes because they make a chemical, and that chemical is called keratin, right? So keratinocyte is just a cell that makes keratin. And what can you tell me about these cells in the epidermis? Are they close together or far apart? Close together, because they're an epithelium, right? There's no matrix in them. So, a matrix between the cells. So where would you expect to find that keratin if there is no matrix? It's not outside the cells. Keratin is intracellular, right? So keratin is intracellular. Remember, collagen is extracellular. It's found in the matrix. All right, so that's the job of these cells, right, is to produce keratin, right, and then some waterproofing material as well. All right, so keratinocytes live for about 40 days or so, and then they die, right? They slough off your body. And so you still want to have skin after 45 days, so what has to happen? Mitosis, right, to replace old and damaged cells. And the living layer of the epidermis is this deepest layer right here, which everybody knows is the stratum basale. That's the living layer undergoing mitosis, right? And then they move up to the surface, right? So cells move from the stratum basale to the most superficial layer, which is the stratum corneum, way up over here. And the stratum corneum is filled with cornified cells, which means that they're dead cells filled with keratin. And keratin is kind of a hard chemical, and that's what gives the epidermis a little bit of strength. Some epidermal cells have more keratin than others. For instance, your hair is made of epidermis, and it has more keratin, so it's a little bit tougher. Your nails are epidermis, and nails have even more keratin, right? So they're even harder. Right, the shape of these cells in the stratum basale, they're columnar to cuboidal in shape, but as they move up to the surface, what happens to their shape? They get squished, right? So they turn into flat cells or squamous cells. So as you go from stratum basale to stratum corneum, the cells die, and the shape of the cells also change from columnar to squamous. Okay, the stratum corneum sometimes can produce a callus, right? If you're writing all the time with your right hand and you look at your middle finger, you might notice that there's a callus there where you hold your pen. And so that's just an adaptation of your skin to that abrasion that takes place all the time, or friction. And you can also develop corns, most likely in your feet, right? And that's where the stratum corneum produces a really hard, highly keratinized layer of cells, and these usually are over some kind of bony prominence that is undergoing a lot of abrasion, maybe wearing certain kinds of shoes or something like that. And that kind of protects the bone a little bit, but it can be very painful nonetheless. Okay. All right, so what about layers in the epidermis? That's what we want to look at. And in anatomy, we make a really big deal of layers, okay, because that's how we understand disease processes. We look at cells and try to see what's happening with these cells. Are they changing shape? Are there different kinds of cells there? All right, so by looking at layers, we can come up with a diagnosis of what's happening to a person as far as disease is concerned. And when you have a diagnosis, what else kind of follows from that? Treatment, that's right. You can't come up with a treatment if you can't diagnose it, right? But there's something else that's kind of nice. You can also get prognosis, right? So if you understand layers, you can understand treatment and prognosis. And what is prognosis? What are the likely outcomes of treatment? That's what prognosis means, right? So if you have a certain form of cancer and it can be diagnosed, then you might know if it's easily treated and you might have a normal life after that, after it's treated, or you might have a very aggressive form of cancer, right? And you'll get an idea, well, gee whiz, you know, you might only be able to live for 6 months or something because that cancer is hard to treat and it grows very rapidly. So layers. Would you like to know how long you're going to live? Well, yes and no. I mean, as opposed to like if you have just a couple weeks or potentially more than that, right? So knowing layers is really important because you can get some kind of idea of your lifespan. Okay. So what are these layers? All right, we start here by just looking at the epidermis. The dermis is way down over here. All right, so the first layer is the stratum basale. That's the living layer. And if I look at this illustration very carefully, I don't see any cells in mitosis, but this is the region that is proliferating, which means growing, and cells or layers or organs grow by the process of mitosis that we looked at. Right, so we would expect to see some cells here, not in interphase, but maybe anaphase or metaphase or some other kind of phase, or some other phase where at least you can see chromosomes inside the cytoplasm. Okay, so this is the growing layer. If you take a seed, what's one of your favorite plants? Okay, tomato plant. Kind of pops into my mind. Maybe I have some tomato seeds right here, but I would really like to have some tomatoes. What would I do with that seed? Maybe stick it in the ground, water it, give it some heat. What's going to happen to that seed? It's going to come to life, right? It's going to sprout. It's going to start growing. Some roots are going to grow down. Some stems are going to come up. That process of coming to life or making a lot more cells is what we call germination. So sometimes the stratum basale right here is called the stratum germinativum because this is what? The growing layer within the epidermis. Okay. That's kind of an archaic term. I don't know if it's in your book. Probably it's in your book. Okay. Germinativum. But usually now we just call it the stratum basale. All right. So what's in there? Keratinocytes. Okay, undergoing mitosis. Ah, there's a couple other cells. Good thing I read that slide. I see some other things going on right here. I see this cell, and maybe it looks kind of dark gray or brown to you. Maybe. What does it look like? Gray. Okay. And that's different than these cells over here. These kind of, I don't know what these are, orange or something. Okay. So anyway, this is a different color. This cell right here produces another kind of chemical, which is not keratin, and it's called melanin. And melanin is a pigment. Okay. So unless you've taken a physics class or something, I'm not sure anybody knows what a pigment is. But a pigment is a chemical. It's a molecule that can absorb a certain energy of light, a certain wavelength of light. And when the wavelength of light or the energy of light changes, then to our eye and our brain, the color changes, right? So a pigment is a chemical that can absorb color from light, and not all kinds of colors. Like, for instance, here I have a nice yellow folder right here. So there's a pigment in this folder that absorbs blue, absorbs red, absorbs green, right, and violet. What it doesn't absorb is a yellow color of light. So that when it hits this piece of paper, what does that yellow do? It doesn't get absorbed, it bounces back, and your eye sees that wavelength of light. So there's a pigment in here that allows you to see yellow. So I don't want to talk about that just at the moment because I'm going to have to think. It has to do a little bit with refraction as well. Okay. That's probably a pretty good way of thinking about it. Okay. But so here is a cell that is very dark, brown to black when it's in its natural form. Okay, which means what? It absorbs a lot of light, so it doesn't reflect any back. It just absorbs a lot of light. So if this cell is absorbing light, that light energy can't get down into the dermis and harm the structures that are in the dermis. Right? And in particular, that chemical, which we call melanin from this melanocyte, can also absorb harmful wavelengths of the sun, like ultraviolet light. Our eyes can't see ultraviolet. So this melanocyte right here is important because it acts like a natural sunscreen protecting a person's skin from the harmful effects of the sun. Okay, and we do know that all of our skin ages as we grow older, all right, and some of us damage our skin quite severely. And what is the most damaging thing you can do to skin? Is sunlight, is just go out in sunlight, unprotected, right, without a shirt, without sunblock on, okay. So the more melanocytes you have, of course your skin is darker, but the more you are protected from the sun, and that's a really important feature. All right, so melanocyte for sunblock. Here is another cell, and it has a bunch of these little spidery legs that we call processes. This is a dendritic cell. This fights infection, so it almost crawls around between the other keratinocytes right here, looking for bacteria, looking for fungi, viruses, and things like that, and then it will destroy those particles so that you don't become infected. Another name for a dendritic cell is a Langerhans cell, and I think your book talks about a Langerhans. The exam figure that you have to study from actually labels it a Langerhans cell. So dendritic and Langerhans are exactly the same. All right, so we know three different kinds of cells: keratinocytes, melanocytes, Langerhans cell, and there's a third cell right here. This is a tactile cell. So again, this kind of cell right here is involved with very light pressure and very slight vibration. Okay, can send information to the brain via this nerve. So you do have some sensation in the epidermis, but do you see any blood vessels right here? No blood vessels. So as they move farther and farther away, even from this dermal papillae that has blood vessels, the cells have to die because they don't have oxygen and nutrients when that happens. Okay. So this is what we call a Merkel's disc, which is going to be different from a Meissner's corpuscle, which is in a dermal papillae. All right, so what about these layers? All right, so there are some layers. Before we look at layers, please realize that there's two kinds of skin. And we talked about this in some of the labs. There is skin like you see on the posterior surface of your hand. And can you understand why this is the posterior surface that I'm pointing to right here? Because in anatomic position, your thumbs are going to be pointing laterally, and that's the surface that's going to be posterior. Can you tell the difference between the skin that's on your posterior hand compared to your anterior hand? Does it look different? Absolutely. Okay. One is thick, right? The anterior surface is thick, but it's also, there's something else, an easy characteristic to see right away. The palms of your hands don't have hair follicles, right? But the back of your hands certainly do. All right, so that's going to be a big difference that you'll see right away between thick skin and thin skin. Thin skin has hair follicles on it. And when I look at this illustration of skin, okay, I see this to be thin skin for the following reason. Here is the stratum basale, that's the deepest layer. The layer right above that, I see a bunch of spiky cells, that's the stratum spinosum. So these keratinocytes are beginning to get glued together, right, and they start to stretch out a little bit. And where they're glued together at these locations, then they kind of develop a little spike, right, or a process sticking out of them. All right, so that's the stratum spinosum. And then they move up to this layer right here, and the cells start to produce some precursors to keratin, as well as some lipid molecules, and the lipid molecules act as a waterproofing for the skin. And that lipid then is secreted outside the cell, so there's like a little oily material right in here that's a permeability barrier. And the precursors to all those chemicals are packaged in these vesicles inside the cell that gives it a granular appearance, and hence we call that the stratum granulosum. And then they get pushed up to the surface way far away from these blood vessels, and they can't maintain life. Right, so they die, but all the chemicals that are inside of them are stuck right there, right, and still perform some kind of function. That chemical is keratin, right, and that's kind of a hard chemical. Then it gives some strength to this stratum corneum. So this is thin skin because it only has these four layers: basale, spinosum, granulosum, and corneum. Thick skin is going to have an additional layer between the granulosum and the corneum here, which is going to be really thin, but it's going to be filled with cells that are very clear, very loose, clear meaning like lucid, like you can look right through them. And so we call that the stratum lucidum, okay, that we find in thick skin. Okay, so what do I have right here? I just have four. Okay, so this is thin skin on your lecture notes right here. Okay, so make sure you can answer some of these questions, like why? That's a good idea. Make sure you can answer that question. Oh, I had a philosophy teacher once take an anatomy class from me. And on the final exam, I gave everybody the usual cumulative final exam, but for her, I gave her one piece of paper with one question on it, and I gave her why. And I thought she would find that funny, but she was really mad at me for that. I don't know. And so I was going to ask her why, but I thought I better not ask her why she was mad at me. So I gave her a regular test. Okay. Okay, in thick skin only, okay, there is an additional layer, so I'm not going to repeat basale, spinosum, granulosum, and corneum, but the next layer is lucidum. That's a clear layer, right? So that's just a transition zone between the granulosum and corneum, and it's a really thin layer, but it stands out because it really doesn't stain. It doesn't pick up any stain, and it stands out really, really nicely. So what do we have right here? Here is a nice micrograph of skin. Not just of the epidermis, but skin in general. And so here is here's the basement membrane for the epidermis, and then down over here is the dermis. And here now you can see a bunch of collagen fibers. And I would ask you what layer that is, but that's not so hard because here it's labeled, right? So that layer that's filled with collagen is the reticular layer. The layer on top of that, or superficial to that, doesn't have as much collagen, but it's still in the dermis. That's what we call the papillary layer, because all of these projections are what we call dermal papillae. Okay, then the basement membrane once again, and then we're into the epidermis. So here's the stratum basale, stratum spinosum. I see a dark layer right here, which is the granulosum, and you see this light layer right through here. That's the stratum lucidum. Okay. And then superficial to that is stratum corneum, and look how thick the stratum corneum is, right? So hence, that's how this kind of skin got its name, thick skin. But you can also tell because of stratum lucidum right here. But this slide is also kind of nice because you can see some collagen fibers right in the matrix of that connective tissue. Let me show you. Okay, see this little white line right here, right at the tip of the cursor? Is really, really thin. That's the stratum lucidum. And if you follow it over here, you can see it's superficial to the granulosum, which is that dark cell right there. Okay. So we have some models in lab where these things are really nicely shown. And in Blackboard, I have three videos that describe that model, which you should look over and over and over and over again. The first video, I believe, is just talking about the epidermis. The second video is talking just about the dermis, and then the third video is about accessory structures like hair and nails and receptor organs like Pacinian corpuscle, things of that nature. So definitely take advantage of that. And then let me know if you think it's helpful. Probably you might think it's helpful. Okay, dermis, I think we talked about already. Connective tissue, areolar. Right, if it's in the papillary, dense irregular if it's in the reticular layer, strength comes from collagen, but there are elastic fibers, maybe a few reticular fibers, but I don't know if anybody cares about that because they're so weak. And the fibers are oriented in all directions, right, so that's what we mean by irregular connective tissue. So your skin is not particularly strong in one direction when it's pulled, right, but it kind of resists pulling in all directions, but it's not strong like a tendon in one particular direction. Okay, but since there are elastic fibers there, your skin can't stretch, and when your skin gets overstretched, those elastic fibers can be damaged, right? For instance, during pregnancy and things like that, and it damages the skin, and you're left over with a little bit of a scar, and that we call those striae, or what? Stretch marks, that's right, stretch marks. I was going to say birthmark, but that's not a birthmark, it's a stretch mark. Okay. Now, don't forget about those projections into the epidermis that we call papillae. Here are the dermal papillae. And the best way to think about those, the reason why they're there, is because there are blood vessels that poke up in here. And so that capillary in this region can supply nutrients and oxygen to this much wider area, okay, bigger area of the epidermis compared to if all the blood vessels were just stuck down underneath the stratum basale. Okay. Is collagen intracellular or extracellular? It's extracellular. It's in the matrix, right? So it's in a connective tissue. All right, name the cell that produces collagen. That's a fibroblast. Okay, now what about keratin? Is that intracellular or extracellular? It's intracellular, and what's the name of that cell? That's a keratinocyte, right? So this chapter in lab is sort of interesting because you get to know layers, you get to know the names of cells, and then you get to know some chemicals that those cells are producing, right? So it's a whole bunch of different kind of material that you have to know. Okay. Oh, gee whiz, I talked about this already. Okay, reticular layer. I think I want to show you some more things. I might be talking way too fast. Let me look through some of these slides right here. Okay. Well, we're doing pretty good. Let me look at this slide. Okay, so I see stratum basale right here. Do I see any mitosis taking place? I do not. Okay, then some spiky cells, spinosum. Then I see some granules in here for sure, so that's granulosum. And then stratum corneum. So if you were going to look at this microscope slide, would you say this is thick skin or thin skin? Thin skin, because there's no stratum lucidum here. No stratum lucidum. And then if we were to have a bigger area to look at, we would see some hair follicles as well. Okay, I'm going to go back to this slide right here. All right, so what did I miss out on this slide? Well, we talked about this Pacinian corpuscle, Meissner's corpuscles that would be tucked up in this papillae. Well, we didn't talk very much about our glands. And on this illustration, I see two glands, and the models in lab actually have three. And I'll mention what the third one is. Here is an eccrine sweat gland, right? And this is the one that's responsible for secreting sweat. Now, what kind of gland is that? An endocrine gland or an exocrine gland? Exocrine, because it has a duct, right? That sweat is then produced and then put into the bloodstream to get carried someplace. It's secreted into this duct that carries it to the surface of the skin. All right, so that's designed primarily to control body temperature. This gland over here, always associated with a hair follicle, is what we call a sebaceous gland. And it secretes sebum, it's another name of a chemical, okay, onto the shaft of this hair follicle as it is growing. All right, so that just allows for some lubrication so that this hair shaft doesn't get stuck down in the dermis, right? So it continually can grow up to the surface of the skin. And sebum, okay, also fights infection. It's not like an antibiotic, but it's kind of like a bacteriostatic kind of chemical, right? So it aids in fighting bacterial infections. All right, so those are two glands. What's not shown on this slide will be a gland that looks like this eccrine gland, but it's, okay, in diameter, it's at least twice the diameter, which means it's huge, right? So it's probably 10 times the volume of this eccrine gland right here. And that's what we call an apocrine gland. An apocrine gland secretes sweat, so it's a sweat gland, so it secretes water and salts, but it also secretes some other organic molecules, right? And those organic molecules end up on the surface of the skin, right? And of course, you have a lot of bacteria, just the natural microbiota growing on your skin. And they can use those organic molecules as a food supply, as a nutrient source. And the organic materials secreted by an apocrine gland are not odoriferous, but those bacteria are. Okay? So we have apocrine glands on some of those more odoriferous areas on our body. Like, for instance, where would you think? Yeah, but what do we want to call an armpit? That's why I asked you this question. Axillary, yeah, your axillary region, okay. Inguinal region, right, have apocrine glands. And we don't really know exactly why they're there, but that's probably because we can't do a lot of experiments on people, right? Absolutely. Okay. So there have been a lot of experiments in other kinds of animals, right? So there are hormones that are contained in your body that go from one area of your body to another to help regulate and control each other. Okay. So there's something from the pituitary called growth hormone. It goes to bone and muscle, and guess what it does to bone and muscle? Makes them grow. Okay. So that hormone is regulating certain processes inside you. All right, there's another kind of signaling compound that has been characterized and recognized very nicely in other kinds of animals, and it's a chemical that's secreted by one animal, but it doesn't stay in that animal's body. It goes to the environment where it's picked up by another animal, okay? And it helps regulate behavior within a group of animals or between two animals, and we call that a pheromone, okay? So it's kind of like a hormone, but it's not really picked up by the blood. It's picked up by the environment and carried to another organism someplace. Okay? And that's characterized really nicely in other animals, but not so well in humans. But we have some evidence that it probably works in humans as well. Because way back when, a number of years ago, when you went to college and you lived in a dormitory, okay, the dormitories were not co-ed. There'd be a women's dormitory over here and a male dormitory over here for guys. And when all the females would move into the dormitory, they would all be on different cycles. Okay? But by the end of the semester, guess what happens? All the ladies start to cycle together. Okay? And it's not because they were reading the same book or taking the same classes. Okay? There's something going on there, and so we just presume that it is regulated by some kind of pheromone. Okay? So that's some indirect evidence. It's not really a scientific experiment that really proves that. Okay, so some of those organic compounds, right, secreted by apocrine glands might have some functions along the lines of pheromones working between people. Okay. All right, so here we see a hair follicle right here. And what can you tell me about the stratum basale compared to the stratum corneum? What do you know about? What's the difference between those two? The corneum is what kind of cells? They're dead, right? They're keratinocytes filled with keratin, but they're dead. And what can you tell me about the stratum basale way down over here? They're alive, right? They're undergoing mitosis, right? So mitosis means growth, replaced old and damaged cells. All right, so let's think about burns for a second, because we do burn the integument every once in a while, and some people do get burned kind of severely. So let's talk about some different degrees of burning as regard to this skin right here in terms of the integumentary system. All right, somebody might reach for a pot that's on the stove that's really hot, but they realize it pretty quickly, and they move their hand, and they end up with just a red area. Hurts really bad, but they just end up with a red area that maybe swells up a little bit, but not too much, but it's primarily red because these blood vessels in the derma papillae start to dilate, right? So more blood gets into that area. Some of it might leak out, okay, and just form a red area right here. That's what we call a first-degree burn. And when you get a first-degree burn, you're really lucky, right? Because it hardly damages anything. It just causes these blood vessels to leak a little bit more. And it might damage a few nerve endings, so it hurts really bad, but generally you can heal from that easily. Second degree burn, where these blood vessels are damaged so much that they become very leaky, and they leak a lot of fluid between the epidermis and dermis right here, causing a blister. Okay, so that person was exposed to a little bit higher temperature, or maybe for a little bit longer period of time. Right, but still, that person is pretty lucky because all of these cells in the stratum basale have not been damaged, right? It's just the wall of this capillary that has changed a little bit so that it leaks some more fluid. All right, so if the stratum basale hasn't been damaged, what happens to that person's skin with a second degree burn? It just grows back, no problem, right? So they don't have a hole in their integument, don't have to worry about infection, don't have to worry about dehydration. So that person is really lucky. Okay, now let's say we have another person that experienced a burn and it actually killed all of the cells in the epidermis and burned material all the way down to this level where I have the cursor, right? Way past the stratum basale in what we see the epidermis right here. Is that person lucky or is that person unlucky? Unlucky, you say unlucky. I tricked you, okay? That person, I say, is still pretty lucky for the following reason, and it has to do with layers. Let's look at these layers. All right, so what's the deep layer once again? Basale, then spinosum, granulosum, corneum. And remember, the basale is the living layer. Okay. In your notes, I say a hair follicle is really important because it's a reservoir of stratum basale cells, living cells. So let's follow this stratum basale over to a hair follicle, and what happens? It goes down over here, it makes the sebaceous gland, and you know most glands are made out of epithelium, but then here's stratum basale all the way down here, deep down into the dermis. Right, and where did we say damage occurred? Right at this layer here. So a person that received even a third degree burn down to this layer still has living epidermal cells down in the dermis that are surrounding this papillae. So what happens to that person's skin? You know, it can regrow. So that's why I think they're really lucky, okay? It's really unfortunate that happened, and you have to worry about, what are some things you have to worry about if you're missing all of this epithelium here? Dehydration and infection, for sure, but eventually that skin is going to grow back from these living cells that we find all over the place, at least in what kind of skin? Thin skin, right? Because that's where these hair follicles are. All right, so what would the really unlucky person experience? Some damaging heat that kills all the cells to this layer right here. Now, all those stratum basale cells are gone, so that part of the integument can't grow back. And in that case, what would that person need? They would need a skin graft, right? And of course, then you really have to be concerned, well, about dehydration and infection too, but even any kind of third degree burn, you'd have to be really concerned about that. All right, so that's another reason why we're really interested in layers of tissues and where they go, because that determines treatment, determines prognosis, and those are all really important things to know about. Okay, so I tried to trick you with that a little bit. Okay, what about the organs? We talked about Pacinian corpuscle for deep pressure. Maybe I didn't mention that. Deep pressure and large vibrations can be picked up by a Pacinian corpuscle, and you can see they're a lot deeper in the integument compared to Meissner's corpuscles that are going to be in this region here. And then I see free nerve endings around this hair follicle to detect motion of hair follicles, but you also have free nerve endings positioned in different areas of the dermis, and those free nerve endings have a couple purposes. One purpose is to detect pain, to detect damaging stimulus to the integument. And of course, we don't really ever want to feel pain due to those stimulation of those nerve fibers. But of course, you have to realize that's a really good thing that you can feel pain. Why is that? Why is that a really good thing? Yeah, because if you're damaging the skin, you have some kind of damaging stimulus and you couldn't feel it, then that would continue to damage your integument. But if you feel that damage occurring in your integument, then you withdraw that part of your body from that damaging stimulus, whether it's temperature or lacerations or whatever. Okay. Also, these free nerve endings are important for temperature sensation. It doesn't necessarily regulate temperature in your body, okay, but you still can feel temperature on your skin. And you have hot nerve fibers that can detect things that are hot, and you got other nerve fibers that can detect things that are cold. So usually there are two classes. One thing that's kind of funny about the nerve endings that can sense hot temperature, sometimes some of them also respond, some of the cold nerve endings, okay, which sense cold, like if you put an ice cube on them, some of the cold nerve endings can also be stimulated by very hot conditions. So have you ever maybe stepped in a shower and it was too hot? It didn't really feel like it was burning, it actually felt cold, okay? So that's kind of just an anomalous sensation. So some of the cold nerve endings are sensitive to hot temperatures, but they're wired to a part of the brain that is for sensing cold information. So that information goes to the cold sensing part of the brain, and you sort of feel cold even though right? It could even be a hot damaging stimulus to the skin. All right, so free nerve endings are for pain and for temperature that we see right here. Okay, what about some accessory structures? I think in lab I'm going to show you this picture. We can actually see these friction ridges and openings of sweat glands on the doc camera. Okay, I'll grab the student and stick their finger underneath it or use my finger and you can see these. So what kind of skin are we looking at here? That's going to be thick skin. Yeah, because the dermal papillae form these ridges, right, on the surface of the skin. Okay, let's look at some nails. So here we see a fingertip, and here is a bone in this particular finger. And a finger in anatomy is called a digit, right? So you have 5 digits on one hand, 5 digits on another, 5 digits on one foot, 5 digits on another. Okay, things that make up a digit, okay, there are bones. And so here is a bone, and in most digits you have 3 bones. Your thumb and your big toe, there's only 2. But this looks like not a thumb or a big toe. So there's going to be 3, but we just see the end of the very last bone right here. All of those bones that make up a digit we call a phalanx. Plural will be phalanges. All right, so phalanges make up digits. So there's a difference between a digit and a phalanx, right? A phalanx is a bone. A digit is this whole finger apparatus. So here I see a phalanx. We haven't learned that yet. Then I see some adipose tissue. I see some blood vessels. And then I see nice skin over everything like dermis and epidermis. Okay. But protecting the distal end of every digit is this nail right here. And the nail is growing from a part of the skin that we call the nail matrix. So the nail matrix is the growing end. It has what, stratum basale cells that are growing, and as they grow, that pushes the skin cells out in this direction, out from underneath the proximal nail fold right here. And they're keratinocytes, and these keratinocytes are filled with what kind of compound? Keratin, which is a strong, relatively strong compound. So the keratinocytes in a nail have just more keratin than the rest of the stratum corneum in your body, so it's a lot tougher material. Okay. Underneath this nail fold right here is what we call the root of the nail. So we got root of the nail, and then we have the body of the nail, and then here's the free edge of the nail. All right, so don't be confused and say that the root of the nail is where the nail grows from, because now you know it grows from the nail matrix down over here, right? So that if you damage the root, the nail of the root right here, what's going to happen to the nail? It's going to grow back. But if you damage or kill the nail matrix, then it's never going to grow back. Okay, so that's the big reason for that. Here's the cuticle or the epinicium. And in this region right here, sometimes we have kind of a white area. We call that the lanula. And it's just due to the amount of blood vessels, right, in that particular region. They just don't come to the surface, right? So you just kind of see a white area. Okay. All right, so that's what you should know about nails. That might be an exam figure, this one here, or, yeah, that one. Okay. Okay, so here is a nice hair follicle. The part of the hair that's sticking above the surface of the skin is what we call the shaft. So here's the hair shaft, and the hair grows out, okay, from the skin. Here's that erector pili muscle, which attaches to the hair follicle on one end and a papillary region on the other end. When it contracts, it kind of makes the hair stand up on end, but it also tries to pull it up to the surface of the body, forming that pimple right there. Here's that sebaceous gland that we talked about before, right? Made of just the epidermis. It's an epithelium that secretes a sebum. Right? The part of the shaft that's below the level of the skin is what we call the root of the hair. Okay, the hair root. And then there's a little swelling down at the bottom, and that's what we call the bulb. I'm going to show you another picture of that hair bulb in just a second. We talked about that just a little bit in terms of looking at that stratum basale all the way around this hair follicle right here, and how an important reservoir for living cells that is. All right, so if we were to make a cross-section of a hair, you can see that it's just not all one kind of cell, that there are layers even within hair. And, ooh, we didn't do this, but we should actually pull our hair out in lab and look at it underneath the microscope, right? And we'd be able to see some of these layers. You'd be able to tell that hair is not the same color all the way through, unless you wanted it to be. How could you want it to be that way? Yeah, if you dye it with a hair color, okay? Then it would be the same all the way across. Okay, so we have the follicle wall on the outside, and you can see some cells sloughing off of that. That's really easy to see underneath the microscope, these little scaly things coming off each hair, right? And then we have a membrane that surrounds this external epithelium root sheath right here. And then we have the cuticle of the hair, and then on the inside, okay, we have something called the medulla. And then surrounding the medulla of a hair shaft is the cortex. So I think this is important nomenclature to understand. So here is medulla, right? Here is cortex. Which one is the deep area of this hair shaft or this hair root? The medulla, right? And the superficial region right here is what we call the cortex. And we're going to use that nomenclature to talk about many glands inside the body. The superficial region is what we call the cortex. The deeper region of any kind of structure is what we call the medulla. So bones have a cortex. Bones have a medulla. The adrenal gland has a cortex. The adrenal gland has a medulla. And they're much different from each other, and hence we have to give them different names. Okay. All right, so here you see... Here you see the hair bulb, okay, and there are melanocytes. So here's the stratum basale, right? So here's the stratum basale with melanocytes, and of course these melanocytes change the color of our hair, right? Some of us produce a melanin which is more black. Some of us produce a melanin that's more brown. Okay, some of us had red hair, which means these melanocytes are taking a little bit of iron from someplace and putting that into these keratinocytes, which gives our hair a little bit of a red color. All right, so this is the nice stratum basale. And then here is like a dermal papillae. And what's the function, what did we say the function of a dermal papillae is? We don't call it a dermal papillae, we call it a hair papilla. Okay, but I see a circular thing here and a circular thing here. That's where capillaries enter the hair bulb. And those capillaries then bring in oxygen and nutrients so that this stratum basale can grow and live. All right, so that's really the reason why this hair papillae is there. Same reason why there are dermal papillae in other parts of your skin. Okay, so I think that's all I want to talk about as far as skin goes. But I do want to talk about some functions of color, pigments. Okay, in your skin. Okay, let's go over here to this slide. Skin color. So we talked about these hair accessory structures. So don't forget that arrector pili muscle is an accessory structure. All right, so skin color. Don't forget, sign-in sheet is going around. You got it down here? Fantastic. I'll get it from you when class is over. All right, so a pigment is any kind of chemical that can absorb light. And if it absorbs all the wavelengths of light, then it doesn't reflect any light back to your eye, and it looks dark. It looks brown or black, right? If it doesn't absorb the yellow wavelength of light, that gets reflected back to your eye, and you see the color yellow, right? So it all depends on what kind of wavelength a pigment picks up. But we also have blood in the integument, and so that gives our skin kind of a red or pinkish hue, right? So that produces color. Don't forget, melanin is what? A natural sunscreen. And we said the most damaging thing you can do to your skin is go out in sunlight. Right? So people that produce more melanin and darker shades of melanin, right, their skin just looks younger for a much longer period of time as they age because they just are more protected from sunlight when that happens. Okay, we can have moles or age spots. That's just an increased number of melanocytes in one little location in the skin, so it looks a little bit darker. Freckles are an increased melanin production, so the same number of melanocytes, but those melanocytes, for some reason, produce a little bit more melanin, and the color might be a little bit different compared to other parts of the skin. And then here's a condition, albinism. People with albinism can't produce melanin. They're lacking one enzyme to produce melanin, and that's a congenital disease, which means it's inherited from your parents, depending on the kinds of genes that you get. So if a person can't produce melanin, what color is their skin? They're white, right? And it doesn't matter what ethnic background you're from, okay? Your skin is just going to be white, right? Even if your heritage is from Africa, you're going to look like somebody from Africa, but your skin's going to be white. Or every other characteristic is going to be exactly the same, right? And that's pretty much true for all mammals, okay? Usually, there was a town in Illinois that had albino squirrels, just white squirrels, which were really pretty. But they only lived for about 20 years because why? Well, because they're susceptible to sunlight, possibly. But everybody said, you know, because this white squirrel stood out so much from the background, then they were predated against very heavily. That means owls could see them, hawks could see them, right? And so they were just picked off and they just didn't last very long. Okay. But there are certainly humans with albinism, and they have no protection from the sun whatsoever. So if they go out in sunlight in Southern California, they can burn their skin in just a couple minutes. Right? So we don't have very many people with albinism here in Southern California. But where would you live if you had albinism? Yeah, way up north, Seattle. Okay. So if you're really dying to see somebody that has albinism, you could hop up and go to Seattle. Okay. Let's talk about two more things. Are we done at 12? No. 12:05, we're almost done. Cyanosis. All right, cyanosis is when you have a blue color to your skin. All right, and that's due to what's happening in your blood. Blood, when it's oxygenated, looks red. When it's lacking oxygen, then it has a blue color to it. So if you're really freezing and blood supply to your skin gets cut off, it doesn't get back to the lungs, your skin is going to turn a little bit blue if you're really, really cold. But there's another circumstance. If during development your lungs and heart and blood vessels coming off the heart don't develop properly, then your blood isn't oxygenated, right? And when you're born, you have a blue tinge to your body, and that's called cyanosis. Right, and probably you all have heard about that, and that's a really important observation because it goes into assessing the viability of an infant as soon as it's born. It's called the Apgar score. Right, so we look at skin color, look at reflexes and other kinds of things, but if a baby is, or a newborn baby is cyanotic, that's a pretty nice sign that there's some malformation of the heart or lungs or circulation between the two. Jaundice is another condition, but in this condition, somebody's not going to look blue, their skin is going to be a bright yellow color, okay? But not just their skin, but their nails, the whites of their eyes will be a bright yellow, and that is due to a breakdown of red blood cells in a person's body. Or it could be due to liver damage, because what takes care of dead and damaged red blood cells is the liver. So it could be damage to red blood cells, or it could be damage to the liver, producing a compound what we call bilirubin, right, and it has a yellow color to it. Okay, and so that's also important to observe in a newborn baby as well, because they could be suffering from some kind of blood disorder or liver damage, and that would be a nice easy indication that some other tests have to be performed to find out what it is. Okay, so that's it for today. Sign-in sheet is around, and next time, what are we going to do next time? Bones, I think. We're going to start bones next time. Hi. That's the water barrier. That's the permeability barrier. And that starts to develop in the stratum granulosum.